Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you an hour of news, views, information, and commentary. This week, I have 8 readings. Book reviews from the New York Times and the Atlantic Magazine. I have a selection from the Dayton Daily News about archive preservation. There's a reading about the impact of tariffs on hair care products. The topic of medical research will be analyzed in readings from Medical Express News and the St. Louis American newspaper. There will be an obituary from the New York Times. And I'm starting with this article from USA Today newspaper. Trump shifts millions of dollars to HBCUs and tribal schools amid deep education cuts. This was written by Carissa Waddick and published September 15, 2025. The Trump administration says it will reallocate nearly $500 million in additional funding to historically black colleges and universities and tribal campuses as it slashes grant programs for other minority students. The Department of Education announced the plan September 15th as part of its effort to redirect money toward President Donald Trump's chief priorities. The department also plans to award $500 million in grants to charter schools and will invest more than $160 million in American history and civics education programs. In its announcement, the agency cited a report September 9th showing declines in K-12 student achievement as a reason for the additional charter school grants. Today, the department is making 3 massive investments, redirecting financial support away from ineffective and discriminatory programs toward those which support student success, Education Secretary Linda McMahon said in a statement. The move comes days after the administration said it was withholding more than $350 million in grants to minority-serving institutions, including colleges and universities that serve large populations of Hispanic students, arguing that awarding grants based on racial and ethnic enrollment is unconstitutional. The cuts targeted grants for institutions serving Alaska and Hawaiian Natives, Asian Americans, and Pacific Islanders and Hispanic and black students. Trump has long called for the dismantling of the Department of Education. In February, he told McMahon he wanted her to put herself out of a job, a move that would require the support of Congress. The president has sought other methods of decreasing the Education Department's power, including proposing a 15% funding decrease for the agency in his 2026 budget proposal. The additional funding pushes the Trump administration's 2025 investment in historically black colleges and universities to more than $1.34 billion, and the total for tribal colleges, which are often controlled by Native American tribes, to more than $108 million, the release said. The United Negro College Fund, a nonprofit that funds scholarships for black students, applauded the administration's reappropriation of funds, noting that HBCUs have historically been underfunded. Lodriquez Murray, senior vice president for public policy and government affairs at the organization, described the move as nothing short of a godsend for HBCUs and said it would be used to help schools acquire property, build and maintain facilities, buy laboratory equipment, support students and faculty, and address other needs. Democrats and other college leaders have sharply criticized the administration's changes. Amanda Miller, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Higher Education Programs under President Joe Biden, argued in a LinkedIn post September 15th that the funding changes had surpassed the Education Department's authority. Congress directs how funding is spent. The executive branch implements it. The role of the Department of Education in these grant programs is to shape them to move their priorities ahead, Miller said. It is not just to decide that authorized and appropriated programs shouldn't be funded and to take that money and give it elsewhere for political reasons. After finding that Latino students attended college far less often than their white peers, Congress created the Hispanic Serving Institution Program in 1998 to provide grants to colleges and universities where at least 25% of full-time enrollees are Hispanic. Deborah Santiago, who leads Excelencia in Education, an organization focused on Latino student success, said she believes the Education Department's funding reallocation is a constitutional issue. Mamie Voigt, president of the Institution for Higher Education Policy, echoed that sentiment and expressed concern that the changes pitted resources for one community against resources for another. The quick changes to competitive grant programs for Hispanic-serving colleges and other organizations could have damaging effects for students, she said. That was the article, Trump Shifts Millions of Dollars to HBCUs and Tribal Schools Amid Deep Education Cuts. This was written by Carissa Waddick and published September 15, 2025, at the USAtoday.com website. Next on today's African American Hour, I have a short reading from the Dayton Daily News newspaper out of Ohio. This was published July 31st, 2025, and it's titled, Center Receives Diversity Award. The Center for Radio Preservation and Archives at WYSO, a nonprofit community-owned public radio station in Yellow Springs, Ohio, is the 2025 recipient of the Diversity Award given by the Society of American Archivists. The award recognizes outstanding contributions in advancing diversity within the archives profession, the Society of American Archivists, or the Archival Record. WYSO and its Center for Radio Preservation and Archives has pioneered a combination of local and national archives work that advances diversity within the archives field. While there are four projects under the center's umbrella, its most ambitious and catalyzing work to date is the HBCU Radio Preservation Project. This project is dedicated to honoring and preserving the vibrant history and cultural resource that is HBCU radio. That was the story, Center Receives Diversity Award. This was published in the Dayton Daily News newspaper on July 31st, 2025. My next reading is titled, Tariffs Are Leaving Black Beauty Businesses in Peril. This was written by Ariana McLemore and published August 19, 2025 at the website Reuters.com. Earlier this summer, Deja Blackshear Calloway, 34, started to notice that her regular clients weren't visiting her hair salon as often as they used to. The salon in Smyrna, Georgia, houses two stylists and offers dozens of services that range from $50 natural hairstyles to $745 tape-in weave extensions. Her most popular services are $254 sew-ins, where human hair extensions are woven into braids, and $125 quick weaves, where human or synthetic hair is styled and then glued to a stocking cap. But the prices of hair extensions and hair glues used to create wigs and weaves have gone up exponentially after U.S. President Donald Trump imposed a series of different tariffs on China and Vietnam, where the majority of black beauty products are made. The price of a package of hair imported from Vietnam has gone up to $290 from $190 since May. A bottle of hair glue imported from China has gone up from $8 a bottle to $15 a bottle at our local beauty supply store. We're being impacted at every level, Blackshear Calloway said. I'm either having to eat that cost or pass that expense along to my clients, which affects their budgets and pockets as well. To avoid passing on rising costs, Blackshear Calloway is asking her clients to bring their own hair to their appointments. Now her salon is offering a quick weave service without hair for $140, but with hair, the price is $400 according to her booking website. She's also struggling to get products since her wholesaler is delaying shipments as tariff rates fluctuate. Khadija Dasso, 30, owner of Dasso Beauty, which sells hyperallergenic braiding hair, as well as the Dasso Hair Salon in Philadelphia, has also faced delayed shipments on imports from China. We have to provide more specifics of the products, exact materials, the product use, for it to clear customs, Dasso said. Part of the issue was that the same language that we've been using for years wasn't descriptive enough. She wants to avoid rising prices on her $13 packets of hair, which customers typically buy at least 5 at a time to complete one hairstyle. Tariffs are disproportionately impacting black business owners like Blackshear Callaway and Dasso, said Andre Perry, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Many black entrepreneurs started off with less wealth, Perry said. He said that the wealth gap puts black entrepreneurs, especially those in low-margin businesses like consumer goods or hair care services, into precarious financial positions as tariffs eat into their bottom lines. Sina Golara, an assistant professor of supply chain and operations management at Georgia State University, said rising costs due to tariffs are like a tax that you're imposing on businesses. In some cases, it could be borne by the foreign manufacturer, but in most cases, it will also have quite a substantial impact on the domestic buyers and consumers, Golara said. Diane Valentine, 55, founder of Slay Hair, first felt the impact of tariffs shortly after the initial 145% tariff was imposed on China, and she faced a $300,000 bill to get 26,000 units of braiding hair out of the Los Angeles port in May. To lose that kind of money at this stage has been devastating, Valentine said. Since then, she has raised the prices of her braiding hair and drawstring ponytail extensions by 20%. She also laid off 4 employees and is working 16-hour days to compensate in her 2 Glow Flow beauty supply stores in Inglewood and Hawthorne, California. Slay Hair supplies $8.49 non-toxic braiding hair and $36 synthetic drawstring ponytails to TJ Maxx and Marshalls, which have resisted renegotiating prices or delivery deadlines to compensate. So essentially, we paid more for our ponytails than TJ Maxx and Marshalls paid for them, Valentine said. She is also trying to renegotiate price increases with Target, where she sells in at least 70 stores in California, Nevada, and Colorado, she said. TJ Maxx and Marshalls declined a Reuters request for comment. 50% of the merchandise comes from China, Valentine said. And prices for synthetic wigs, human hair weaves, plastic hair rollers, rubber bands, combs, and brushes that stock her shelves are trending up at her beauty supply locations. I thought maybe we would see an increase in foot traffic because there would be more DIY hairstyles. More women doing their hair at home, she said. But for right now, we've only seen decreased foot traffic and also a decrease in frequency of visits from our existing customers. While beauty product sales are typically resilient during economic downturns, beauty services are seen as discretionary, said Marley Brocker, senior analyst at market research firm IBIS World. Tariffs on those imports are going to directly lead to higher costs for those service providers, whether they're buying directly from overseas manufacturers or buying from wholesalers within the United States, she said. Black U.S. consumers spent approximately $2.29 billion on hair care products in 2022, according to a Nielsen study from that year. But higher prices are causing some black women to visit the salon less frequently. Deira Fry, 27, of Raleigh, North Carolina, usually schedules hair appointments at least 5 times a year. But so far this year, she's only gone once. Due to the cost of everything rising over the years, I tend to get braids a little more often than sew-ins, or try to maintain my natural hair, she said. She's also seeing prices for her natural hair products like Unilever's Shea Moisture and Procter & Gamble's Pantene go up. Fewer visits are impacting salons and beauty supply stores. Until earlier this year, Dion Maxwell was selling wigs, braiding hair, shampoos, and conditioners out of her mini beauty supply store in Dallas, Georgia, located 33 miles outside of Atlanta. But she shut it down after she started losing foot traffic in May and moved operations into her home. Now she's relying on orders placed through Uber Eats, TikTok Shop, and Walmart.com to sustain her business. But even those sales have slowed significantly, she said. We don't have the money for advertising because enough revenue is not coming in to advertise with us, Maxwell said. Tariffs have raised Maxwell's wholesale price for China-made braiding hair by 50 cents per pack, she said. And she is now required to buy more hair in her wholesale orders. She said she's struggling to renegotiate better prices with her hair wholesalers, who are requiring her to order more units of merchandise at higher cost. Her wholesaler is asking her to purchase 110 packs of hair per order, when she was previously able to buy 30 packs at a time, she said. For the past 2 months, we have been basically paying our bills out of pocket because we really have had nothing coming in, Maxwell said. That was the article, Tariffs Are Leaving Black Beauty Businesses in Peril. This was written by Ariana McLemore and published August 19, 2025, at the website Reuters.com. Next on today's African American Hour, I have the first of two readings today about health research. This reading is from the St. Louis American newspaper, which is the African American newspaper out of St. Louis, Missouri. Its website is stlamerican.com. The title of the article is, Why Don't Black Women Join Clinical Trials? This was written by Shernay Williams and published September 15, 2025. A simple question sparked complicated answers. Would you participate in a clinical trial? I would be nervous, Baltimore resident Kim Pennington admits. It has to be a sacrifice, and I don't know if I want to sacrifice my health and my life for a trial. She's not alone. Black women make up just 2% of all cancer clinical trial participants. Experts say this lack of participation is one of the reasons black women are 38% more likely to die from breast cancer. Clinical trials test new medications and treatments on volunteers, allowing researchers to determine if they're safe and effective. It's a form of medical research, and they're often the only way patients can get access to the most advanced treatments. Clinical trials are just a marvelous opportunity to get the most cutting-edge therapy that's available, says George Benjamin, executive director of the American Public Health Association. So why are black women underrepresented? The answer lies in a long history of exploitation and exclusion. A 2023 survey of 257 black women across the United States, conducted by the Black Breast Cancer Alliance, found that historical mistreatment of black bodies in the name of medical research contributes to hesitancy like Pennington's. Generations of black folks know about black men and women who were treated unjustly by the U.S. medical community. In the 1840s, gynecologist J. Marion Sims perfected surgical techniques still employed today by operating on enslaved women without anesthesia. Throughout the 20th century, black men and women were sterilized without consent. From 1932 to 1972, the U.S. Public Health Service let hundreds of black men in Alabama go untreated for syphilis. They were told they were being treated for bad blood, but researchers were studying the progression of the disease. In the 1950s, Henrietta Lacks went to Johns Hopkins Hospital complaining of vaginal bleeding. The institution took her cells without consent, and the medical community continues to use them for research today. Her descendants only reached a settlement over her cells in 2023. Today, federal consent and ethics laws protect people participating in research studies. But mistrust isn't the only reason black women stay out of clinical trials. Ricky Fairley, co-founder of TOUCH, the Black Breast Cancer Alliance, says the biggest reason they don't participate is recruitment, or the lack thereof. Whether it's illicit bias, racism, or whatever you want to call it, we're not invited, she says. I know I wasn't asked, says Latoya Bowles Johnson, a breast cancer survivor. I had to push for it. Diagnosed at 36, the mother of three says her doctor shrugged off her request to join a medical trial. She had to find another physician willing to enroll her in a study. Clinical trials do save lives, Bowles Johnson said. Fairley, a breast cancer survivor herself, credits a clinical trial with saving her life. That's why she launched a campaign called When We Trial. The initiative features an online platform where Black women complete questionnaires and are then matched with relevant clinical trials. Fairley says the effort has helped enroll more than 25,000 Black women into clinical trials. Fairley says that when more Black women participate in clinical research, it helps scientists better understand how conditions like breast cancer impact them. A Black breast cancer cell looks totally different from a white breast cancer cell, Fairley says. And guess what the drug cancer treatments are made on? The drugs are made on white cells. A research team at Johns Hopkins University announced similar findings. Diplai Sharma, Ph.D., and her team discovered that breast cancer cells from Black women multiply faster and are more likely to spread to other organs than cells from white women. Over the last several years, she and her team have been comparing breast tissue donated with consent by Black and white women who were diagnosed with triple-negative breast cancer, one of the most aggressive types. Black women are disproportionately affected by this variant of the disease. The Johns Hopkins team is testing a treatment option shown to slow these aggressive cancer cells among Black women. However, before it becomes available to patients, the next step is for researchers to conduct a clinical trial. Black breast cancer research like Sharma's is under threat because of the Trump administration's stance on DEI. For George Benjamin, the head of the American Public Health Association, the stakes couldn't be higher. "We will push back," he says. "In the end, we will win. But if you don't do these things with intention, they won't happen." That intention, he says, starts with trust. Researchers must reconsider their approach to working with members of the Black community if they want to advance medical research. He argues that effective medical research requires cultural sensitivity and relationship building, including with trusted Black physicians and pharmacists who can relay clinical trial information to their patients. Columbia University professor Adana Lonels Wilson, an epidemiologist who's conducted dozens of studies around Black women and breast cancer, agrees. She says the issue isn't getting more Black women to participate in research. It's the medical community's failure to earn their trust in the first place. When we build authentic relationships with communities, when our research teams reflect the populations we aim to serve, and when we show up with respect and transparency, Black women show up too. That was the article, Why Don't Black Women Join Clinical Trials? This was written by Shrenae Williams and published September 15, 2025, in the St. Louis American newspaper at the website stlamerican.com. My next reading on today's African American Hour deals with healthcare. The title is, Better Access to Technology May Help African Americans Bridge the Healthcare Gap. This was written by Sadie Harley and published August 7, 2025 at the website medicalexpress.com. Researchers at the University of California, Santa Barbara have found that better access to technology can go a long way toward achieving equity in healthcare for African Americans in the United States. According to Sharon Tetega, T-E-T-T-E-G-A-H, and Ebenezer Larnyo, L-A-R-N-Y-O, both researchers at UCSB's Center for Black Studies Research, leveraging health technology is a promising strategy for addressing long-standing healthcare disparities by enhancing access to care, improving its quality, and reducing inequities. Our study shows that improving access to technology like broadband internet and smartphones and healthcare technology use like telehealth and health-related social media platforms can significantly reduce healthcare disparities among African Americans, said Larnyo, the lead author of a paper published in the Journal of Frontiers in Public Health. African Americans today continue to face an inordinate amount of difficulty in accessing healthcare, and tend to have worse healthcare outcomes than their white counterparts. Tetica recalled one particularly conspicuous case, that of tennis champion Venus Williams, who throughout her career was plagued with bouts of severe pelvic pain. She had uterine fibroids and had gone to several doctors and nobody was giving her the right response, said Tetica, who directs CBSR and focuses her research at the intersection of social science and STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. They were dismissing her. Indeed, despite the pain and the bleeding, in interviews, Williams herself notes that while she knew she had fibroids, African American women are disproportionately affected by the non-cancerous tumors, her doctors never connected the condition and her pain, telling her that her symptoms were a normal part of her menstrual cycle. Williams ultimately found a team that took her complaints seriously and, because of this experience, now advocates for women's health. Williams' experience of being glossed over by doctors is unfortunately too common for African Americans in the U.S. healthcare system, stemming from a history of systemic racism and historical patterns of exclusion, the researcher said. While she was able to eventually find the appropriate care, many others continue to struggle to be seen. So the question becomes, how do we get the medical community of people who are not people of color to understand that we really do have different needs, Tetica said. And a lot of times that has to come from the patient, but not every patient can advocate for themselves. Socioeconomic status is another major factor. Healthcare in the U.S. takes money, whether it's for health insurance, hospital and clinic visits, medicine and other supplies. Even the ongoing boom in healthcare technologies such as internet-based telemedicine, wearables or precision medicine, which have great potential for leveling the healthcare playing field, are limited to those who can afford them. Higher socioeconomic status individuals are more likely to have technology access, and when they do have access, they experience fewer healthcare disparities, Larnio said. So tackling both digital and structural barriers is key to achieving equity. In their paper, the researchers explore the complex relationship between technology inequities and healthcare disparities among African Americans and uncover statistical connections between socioeconomic status, technology access, and health technology use. Evidence matters, Larnio said. Having hard numbers allows us to move beyond assumptions and demonstrate precisely how socioeconomic factors influence healthcare access in the digital age. It helps us understand the underlying mechanisms through which technology inequity reinforces and perpetuates healthcare disparities and allows us to be able to highlight the role of structural racism in shaping economic opportunities and digital inclusion, thus making a case for structural changes rather than individual solutions. Analyzing data from a survey of 815 African Americans on their access to and use of health-related information and health-related behaviors, perceptions and knowledge, the research collaboration, which includes teams from Jingzhou University in China and Teesside University in the United Kingdom, elucidated this intricate dance of variables. They found a statistically significant relationship between socioeconomic status and technology access. The higher one's socioeconomic status, the more access to technology they have, and a positive association between technology access and health technology use. The more access to technology, the more likely to use health technology. Conversely, they found a negative association between tech access and healthcare disparities. The less access to health technology, the larger the healthcare disparities. The influence that socioeconomic status, technology access, and health disparities have on each other indicates that addressing both socioeconomic disparities and technology access is crucial in reducing healthcare disparities, according to the paper. Some of the most powerful solutions are already within reach. To begin with, broadband internet is foundational. It needs to be affordable, accessible, and reliable, Larnio said. That goes hand in hand with affordable smartphones. In addition, to effectively take advantage of this technology, culturally tailored telehealth, simple-to-use mental health apps, and health-related social media platforms are needed, the researchers said. We definitely need to do more work to raise awareness that people of color have different needs that have to be addressed and not just passed off, Tedega said. Pointing out that ethnic minorities have differing likelihoods for various diseases and conditions. We need to build a narrative that highlights that with advocacy and information, because often you don't know that you don't know. That was the article. Better access to technology may help African Americans bridge the healthcare gap. This was written by Sadie Harley and published at the website medicalexpress.com on August 7, 2025. My next reading is an obituary. James E. Ferguson II, rights lawyer who defended busing, dies at 82. This was written by Sam Roberts and published August 28, 2025, in the New York Times newspaper. James E. Ferguson II, a litigator who was instrumental in persuading judges to desegregate the nation's schools, reverse wrongful convictions in civil rights cases, and spare sentenced prisoners the death penalty, died on July 21st in Charlotte, North Carolina. He was 82. The cause was complications from COVID-19 and pneumonia, his son James Ferguson III said. Even before he became a lawyer, Mr. Ferguson rallied fellow classmates in the Jim Crow South to integrate libraries, lunch counters, and other public facilities in North Carolina, and to engage in multiracial and interfaith dialogue. After receiving his law degree in 1967 from Columbia University, where he said he was among fewer than 15 black students in a class of about 300, he became a partner in what was described as Charlotte's first racially integrated law firm, joining another black lawyer, Julius Chambers, and Adam Stein, who was white, and the father of North Carolina's present governor, Josh Stein. "We weren't practicing law in the abstract," Mr. Ferguson was quoted as saying in Robert Samuel Smith's book, Race, Labor, and Civil Rights, published in 2008. "We were the legal arm of the civil rights movement in North Carolina." In 1971, Mr. Ferguson assisted his partners in persuading the U.S. Supreme Court to uphold busing as a means of integrating public schools. In the landmark case, Swan v. Charlotte Mecklenburg Board of Education, the justices declared unanimously that busing students, without harming their health or academic achievement, was an appropriate and necessary means of implementing the integration that the court had mandated nearly two decades earlier in Brown v. Board of Education. The Swan decision became a model for busing policies across the country. During the litigation of Swan, the modest law office that Mr. Ferguson shared with his partners was intentionally torched. No one was charged in the arson, which did not result in injuries. But Mr. Ferguson said he never forgot the helpless feeling of getting a call at 3 a.m. and then seeing the office aflame. Mr. Ferguson later represented black parents who challenged court decisions that limited but did not overturn the use of busing to achieve integration. Beginning in 2011, Mr. Ferguson worked with Sonia Pfeiffer, whose Charlotte law firm he later joined, in litigating on behalf of four death row inmates under the state's groundbreaking Racial Justice Act, which empowered the courts to revisit capital punishment cases. He led the legal team that succeeded in reducing the inmate sentences to life imprisonment. He endured abuses and threats that made everyone feel seen and heard. That is the civil rights movement, Ms. Pfeiffer said in an interview. What he did for schools across the country was extraordinary, she added. Have we achieved integration and equality in any realm? The answer is no. But Fergie did what he could in the world that existed. It did make a difference. With Amnesty International and other lawyers, Mr. Ferguson also helped overturn the convictions of defendants known as the Wilmington 10. Eight black male high school students, a young black minister, and a white female social worker who were found to have been wrongly prosecuted on charges of firebombing a white-owned grocery store during the civil rights protests in North Carolina in 1971. The protests, ignited by racial turmoil in the schools, had ended in rioting and at least two deaths. The defendants spent almost a decade in prison. The last of them to be released in 1979 was the Reverend Benjamin F. Chavis, Jr. a civil rights leader who became executive director of the NAACP in 1993. The 10 were not pardoned until 2012 by Governor Beverly Perdue, a Democrat. Mr. Ferguson also represented the so-called Charlotte Three, black civil rights activists who were convicted on the basis of flimsy evidence. Two dodgy witnesses were offered cash for their testimony in the arson of a white-owned stable in 1968. 15 horses died. Their inordinately lengthy sentence, 10, 20, and 25 years, were not overturned, but were commuted by Governor Jim Hunt, a Democrat, in 1979. In another high-profile case, joining with the Innocence Project, Mr. Ferguson and other lawyers introduced DNA evidence and a confession by another suspect that led to the exoneration in 2004 of Durrell Hunt, a black man who in 1984 was wrongfully convicted of the rape and murder of a 25-year-old white woman and sentenced to life imprisonment. The case became the subject of a 2006 HBO documentary in which Mr. Ferguson appeared. In his impassioned plea to an all-white jury, which sustained an earlier conviction, Mr. Ferguson said, "If you do justice to Durrell Hunt, you have done justice to the state, to the prosecution, to your country, and to yourselves." James Edward Ferguson II was born on October 10, 1942 in Asheville, North Carolina, the youngest of seven children. His father, James Jr., was a railroad laborer. His mother, Nina, was a housemaid. He described facing a wall of inferiorization throughout childhood because of segregation, including attending an all-black junior high school, and he soon began outreach efforts to students at all-white schools. He received a bachelor's degree in English and history in 1964 from North Carolina College in Durham, now North Carolina Central University, where he was the student body president. He received a Juris Doctor's degree from Columbia's Law School, which he attended on a scholarship, and returned to the South, he said, to work for change. Mr. Ferguson was a partner in the law firm Ferguson Stein, Chambers, Gresham & Sumter, and served as its president from 1984 until he retired in 2024, when the firm was known as Ferguson, Chambers & Sumter. He was also of counsel to Pfeiffer Rudolph of Charlotte. Mr. Ferguson trained black lawyers in apartheid South Africa in the 1980s on trial tactics. He lectured at Harvard Law School, served as a general counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union, and was president of the North Carolina Academy of Trial Lawyers, now North Carolina Advocates for Justice. His wife, Barbara Terman Ferguson, died in 2022. In addition to their son, James, who is also known as Jay, he is survived by another son, Taj, a daughter, Kaylee Ferguson, a brother, William, four grandchildren, and two great-grandchildren. "I just want to feel that I've done all I can do to bring about equality for everybody," Mr. Ferguson told the Charlotte Post, a black-oriented newspaper, in 2016. "That's what life is about, trying to create the society we think we want." That was the obituary for James E. Ferguson II, rights lawyer who defended busing, dies at 82. This obituary was written by Sam Roberts and published August 28, 2025, in the New York Times newspaper. I'm going to wrap up today's program with a couple of book reviews. The title of the first book is The Conjuring of America: Mojos, Mermaids, Medicine, and 400 Years of Black Women's Magic, written by Lindsay Stewart. This appeared in the September 4th, 2025 edition of The Atlantic Magazine in a review titled "How a Tradition Forged in Slavery Persists Today." A new book argues that conjure, a black spiritual practice, has touched nearly every corner of American life. This was written by Danielle Amir Jackson. In Ryan Coogler's 2025 blockbuster movie Sinners, Wunmi Musaku plays a woman named Annie, who makes a living by supplying her neighbors in Clarksdale, Mississippi, with homemade medicinal cures. She has spent years studying the Bible, the human body, and the supernatural. And she is the only character who understands the trouble brewing outside the juke joint where the town's black residents have gathered one evening for a night of music and dancing. Sinners is the most recent depiction in pop culture of conjure, a spiritual practice created by enslaved people, and its creators are not the first to face the tricky task of respectfully invoking a tradition that is more complex and more entangled in American history and culture than many know. Lindsay Stewart's new book, The Conjuring of America, Mojos, Mermaids, Medicine, and 400 Years of Black Women's Magic, arrives amid a wave of visibility for conjure practices. Conjure is a central element not only of Sinners, but also of HBO's 2020 series, Lovecraft Country, where two characters summon a healer to purge a haunted house, as well as Beyoncé's 2016 visual album, Lemonade, in which the artist calls on her ancestors and nature to heal her marriage. It also arrives as black people face the threat of rolled-back civil rights under federal leadership that appears adamant to remove black leaders from government and erase black history from museums and websites. As Stewart makes clear, conjuring has been enmeshed in American life for centuries. A hybrid practice rooted in religions from West and Central Africa, it has been shaped by influences from Christianity, Islam, and indigenous groups in North America. Today, conjurers are not exclusively women. Still, most people familiar with its history associate the practice with them because it is largely a domestic art, carried forward through women's hands and from their homes. Many conjurers believe the spirit world can be petitioned for healing and protections. They may commune with ancestors for guidance, seek remedies in nature, and perform rituals and spells to aid their communities. Stewart makes the convincing case that the conjure woman has managed to stamp her conjure onto American culture so deeply that many of its traditions and cultural touchpoints actually originated in her rituals. If you've ever feasted on black-eyed peas at the start of a new year, danced to a wailing blues like Wang Dang Doodle, or carried a keepsake in your pocket for good luck, you've brushed up against conjure. By tracing a genealogy of conjure, Stewart also seeks to reveal many obscured contributions of black women to American history. She argues that, from the antebellum years through Reconstruction and Jim Crow, black women, many of them guided by conjure practices and wisdom, shaped how the nation birthed its babies, nursed its sick, and clothed and fed its families. In The Conjuring of America, Stewart finds the conjure woman's influences in unexpected places. She sees them, for instance, in the woman who inspired the mammy stereotype, those who labored as nannies, cooks, or wet nurses, but also delivered babies, forged for medicinal roots, and provided medical care for other enslaved people. Conjure shares kinship with other practices forged through transatlantic slavery. Obeah in Jamaica, Santeria in Cuba, and Voodoo in Haiti. These traditions have similar roots but evolved differently, shaped by the various ways African beliefs were suppressed across the New World. Conjure, or hoodoo, as it is often called, may be the reorganized remnants of what was once a more formal religion. Katrina Hazard Donnell writes in Mojo Working, The Old African-American Hoodoo System. Today, if you know where to look or listen, conjure's traces are everywhere. Take denim. Once called Negro cloth, it was for a time made by enslaved artisans who brought knowledge of making indigo dye from West Africa. There, as Stewart writes, women were thought to have been gifted these techniques by the gods. Or take the blues, that quintessential American genre that has shaped so much contemporary popular music. Its songs are stacked with nods to John the Conqueror root, a plant that's thought to enhance luck, and spells to bring back a lover. Some people even believe that singing is itself a form of conjure. The writer Albert Murray claimed that one sang the blues in order to stamp out sadness, almost like an exorcism. W.C. Handy and Coco Taylor sang the praises of Carolyn Dye, a formerly enslaved woman who made mojos, assortments of lucky trinkets usually bound in red flannel, for black and white customers. The same red flannel was often featured in caricatures of Mammy. Perhaps that's why my second oldest aunt collected Mammy figures. She could have seen in them a symbol not of black women's submission, but of their power. For many people, Stewart included, Conjure's echoes ring loudest in the kitchen. In the 1940s, the Creole chef Leah Chase turned a sandwich shop in the Treme neighborhood of New Orleans into a sit-down restaurant called Dookie Chase. It became one of the few Chases that allowed interracial gatherings under Jim Crow. Chase prayed while she prepared food, believing that a person had to love that pot in order to cook well. Stewart connects this habit to the West African Dogon people, who believe that cooking vessels contain spirits. Some accounts of enslaved people recall people crying into pots in despair, which may have been a way of asking the pot spirit to intercede to plead to God on the weeper's behalf. These practices nurture a feeling of safety and defiance, Stewart argues. In 1965, by which point Dookie Chase had become a gathering place for civil rights organizers, a pipe bomb exploded outside the restaurant, Chase told the New Orleans Times Picayune newspaper. As the freedom writer Rudy Lombard had observed, when black and white patrons used to eat there in defiance of segregation laws, the police never bothered them. It was as though God threw a protective ring around the restaurant. Stewart's book shows the many ways in which the Conjure Woman persists in contemporary scholar practitioners who host classes in their communities, in neighborhood candy ladies like Stewart's great-grandmother, who not only sold sweets, but also offered spiritual support to families, along with child care and a bit of tough love if you needed it. It endures an online chatter about hashtag black girl magic. At a time when knowledge itself is being made to feel dangerous, when the Tuskegee Airmen and Harriet Tubman are being stripped from historical records, we can learn from Conjure Women how to maintain and pass down our heritage in a country that has frequently sought to quash it. That was the book review titled, How a Tradition Forged in Slavery Persists Today, written by Danielle Amir Jackson. That was a review of the book, The Conjuring of America, Mojos, Mermaids, Medicine, and 400 Years of Black Women's Magic, written by Lindsay Stewart. This book review appeared in The Atlantic Magazine on September 4th, 2025. My final reading for today is a review of the book Black Moses, A Saga of Ambition and the Fight for a Black State, written by Caleb Gale. The title of this review is The Quixotic Crusade to Create an All-Black State in Oklahoma. This was written by Greg Grandin and published August 15, 2025, in the New York Times newspaper. Go West, the New York newspaper editor Horace Greeley advised in 1865, and African Americans did. During the last decades of the 19th century, tens of thousands of the newly emancipated and already free people of color migrated out of southern states, scraping together money to buy a riverboat or train ticket to St. Louis. From there, they fanned out across the Great Plains to Kansas, Oklahoma, and beyond, some crossing the border to Mexico in search of the Promised Land. Many black migrants, the historian Nell Irvin Painter wrote in the 1970s, understood their flight as biblical, a sequel to God's deliverance of the Israelites from Pharaoh. In their case, deliverance from hooded white vigilantes and debt bondage. Every black man is his own Moses now, is how one migrant described the Exodus. Caleb Gale's Black Moses, A Saga of Ambition and the Fight for a Black State, provides a timely reconsideration of this migration. Gale, a professor of journalism and Africana studies at Northeastern University and a contributor to the New York Times Magazine, begins his book with an overview of the various pre-Civil War plots to remove dark-skinned people from the nation, including plans to send them to Liberia, Haiti, and Central America, among other places. Your race suffers from living among us, Abraham Lincoln told a delegation of African American leaders at the White House in 1862. While ours suffer from your presence. Go where you are treated the best, Lincoln said, suggesting Panama as a potential homeland. Frederick Douglass and other black abolitionists damned such schemes. Our minds are made up to live here if we can, or die here if we must, Douglass wrote. Here we are, and here we shall remain. After the Civil War, here got bigger, as new states were added to the Union. The federal government's distribution of cheap land on the frontier made it possible for black people to imagine staging their own exodus, to preserve their collective identity within the nation. As Gale writes, the idea was to begin again on their terms, to build a future in which they could sleep through the night without fear of being murdered or raped by night riders, send their children to good schools, grow their crops without overlords, vote without hindrance, and live in dignity. At the heart of Gale's book is the story of one especially indefatigable black Moses, Edward McCabe. Born free in Troy, New York in 1850, McCabe eventually landed a job as a clerk in a Wall Street firm in Manhattan. Educated and energetic, he nevertheless had little chance of advancement in the world of finance. So he moved first in 1872 to Chicago, where he studied law and became active in the Republican Party, and then, a few years later, to Kansas. Kansas was sacred ground for Eastern and Southern black citizens. John Brown began his anti-slavery crusade there, and other abolitionists gave their lives fighting for black freedom. Yet, while the state's soil may have been washed with the blood of martyrs, the plains' fierce dust storm seemed demonic. Black pioneers dug shelters out of sod mounds and survived on buffalo meat provided by the nearby Potawatomi. McCabe arrived in one such settlement, Nicodemus, in 1878. He soon became the local notary and clerk, positions Gale notes that made him central to Nicodemus's survival, responsible for distributing rations supplied by charities, the federal government, and private businesses. McCabe helped turn the town into one of the most successful African-American communities west of the Mississippi. With black-run stores, churches, and schools, the mud lean-tos replaced by neat frame houses lining tidy streets. McCabe delivered black votes to state Republican candidates, and in return, he was elected clerk of Graham County and eventually Kansas State Auditor. As Republicans moved away from a commitment to racial equality and white vigilantes began to terrorize black homesteaders in Kansas, he realized that neither racial equality nor his professional ambitions would be accomplished by focusing on the local level. McCabe set his sights on Oklahoma, then still a territory. He began recruiting as many black settlers to fill Oklahoma as possible, with the goal of allowing the territory to enter the Union as a black state. An African-American Zion with black politicians and federal representatives was the only way to realize the promise of abolition. In 1890, McCabe met with President Benjamin Harrison and asked to be appointed governor of Oklahoma Territory. "We are men and women capable of self-government," he told the president. McCabe's dream of African-American liberation required Native American dispossession, since a good part of Oklahoma was already set aside for Native Americans forcibly removed from their ancestral homes east of the Mississippi, including the Cherokee, Creeks, and Choctaw. By the 1880s, Gale writes, Oklahoma was a land both promised and devastated, a dream for poor black migrants and a nightmare for Native Americans, with the federal government opening Indian territory to settlers. In Kansas, Nicodemus sat on wide open prairie, where for centuries people like the Kaw, Osage, and Pawnee had lived, traveled, and hunted. In Oklahoma, African American homesteaders came into conflict with Native Americans, including the Cherokee, who ultimately sold off their land to the highest bidders, white settlers. Black migrants did manage to establish scores of all-black Oklahoma townships, but a black state was not to be. President Harrison didn't appoint McCabe governor, and many of McCabe's detractors, both white and black, balked at his effort to create what some were calling another Haiti in the nation's heartland. Gale writes with great empathy, and though Black Moses contains many tangents, he keeps bringing readers back to a main point, that formal emancipation was meaningless without substantive political power. Gale wasn't the first to note that truth, but his compelling study of McCabe's quixotic crusade for Black self-determination richly illustrates just how tenuous that promise of freedom remained. McCabe died in 1920, 13 years after Oklahoma entered the Union as a state, not as a Black Zion, but as a white-run apartheid. Black migrants had fled the South, but the worst of the South followed close behind, with Oklahoma politicians adopting Jim Crow laws. Literacy tests prevented most African Americans from casting a ballot, making the services of vote brokers like McCabe's obsolete. Native Americans, who in the early 1900s likewise sought to establish their own state, which they hoped to call Sequoia, in the eastern part of the territory, were also disenfranchised under the same rule. Today, with the White House attempting to control discussion of African American history, including in exhibits at Smithsonian Museums, the National Museum of African American History and Culture among them, Black Moses is a useful reminder that for nearly a century after the Civil War, what was called democracy was indistinguishable from white power. That was a review of the book, Black Moses, A Saga of Ambition and the Fight for a Black State, written by Caleb Gale, published by Riverhead. It is 286 pages long and retails for $33. The title of this review is The Quixotic Crusade to Create an All-Black State in Oklahoma. The review was written by Greg Grandin and published in the New York Times newspaper on August 15th, 2025. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to replay this program or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or in the Audio Reader archives at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.